Hi, everybody. I am here on the off week, so there wouldn't normally be an episode this week. And I'm not sure what to call this. I wanted to maybe say bonus, but it feels wrong. The reason that I'm bringing this episode back is that tragically, Anna passed away just about a month ago, I think. And I'm so grateful for the teaching that she offered me when I was a young artist, you know, just fresh out of high school, and then all of the support and, you know, just love and camaraderie that she has offered since then. And especially more recently, I loved having this conversation with her. It was such a treat, and I'm so happy that I did it. You know, that I didn't wait, because of course she's not here anymore. And it just makes me think a lot about how important it is to just, I don't know, have the conversations that we need to have with the people that we want to talk to. So I thought I would just, you know, try to honor Anna, by sharing this again and kind of, you know, hearing some of her beautiful wisdom once more. And also I feel like I just need to say, Anna had a glioblastoma, which is the same brain cancer that, that my mom had. And I don't know, there's just something about that that just hits me in like a really specific way. So yeah, I mean, all this to say, I just felt devastated when I heard the news from Anna that she had a glioblastoma. I know what that diagnosis means. I know that it is terminal. And you know, people always say, oh, well, you know, treatment. But the truth is that glioblastoma just, it takes its victims, and usually it does it quickly. So, I don't know. I was thinking a lot during the very short time between when Anna, announced her diagnosis publicly and, when she passed away. And I have been kind of reflecting about her during that time, and it was really quick. I'm kind of rambling, but I'm also just saying what is, you know, what's in kind of my heart and my mind. So if you are a person who knew Anna Moy, who was a student of hers, who was a colleague of hers, who heard her sing, who interacted with her in any way, I hope that this gives you, you know, I don't know, something just to, if you haven't, you know, heard this conversation, that it's just a few more words from Anna, and just, you know, something else and additional to kind of remember her by. So that's all. And I'll be back, you know, next week. It's officially spring. It will officially be spring. And it's going to be April, which is my favorite month of the year. It's when I was born, but also it's just the best month of the year. So I will be back with some springy episodes for you in April. But for today, I hope you enjoy some words from a few years ago, from the lovely and wise and beautiful Anna Moy. Here comes. Great art almost feels like magic. It opens our minds to brand new ideas and teaches us to see ourselves and our world more clearly. Of course, behind all great art, there are artists, and I think that's where the real magic happens. As we go beneath the art itself to explore how artists do what they do, we see glimpses of the sorts of creativity and resilience that lead to the art that moves our world. And maybe we can learn to borrow some of that magic for our own thinking. That's the goal here. And now that we're on the same page, let's dive in. I'm Emily Merrill, and this is Artifice. First, this is kind of exciting. I am interviewing Anna Moy, who is one of my old voice teachers. Anna was my voice teacher when I was at BYU that one year. So between fall of 2006 and spring of 2007,
yes,
helping me prep for my North Texas audition. So it's always fun to interview a mentor. So I'm excited.
So as long as it's been, and you, I mean, I'm excited to be able to call you a former student.
Thank you.
Whenever I see, I mean, I'm at the age in my career now where, I mean, the vast majority of it is behind me, yeah. And to see how you know, individuals lead out and really follow their passion and, you know, have the courage to step in and do what they feel great about.
Do you find that it's like surprising to see like who kind of ends up doing what?
Sometimes it is. Sometimes it is. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
I've been out of grad school, I think about 10 years now. Yeah, about almost nine years. And, you know, so I haven't been teaching for that long. I've been teaching 11 years. And
That's still a hefty time.
It's a chunk of time. But even after, you know, just 11 years, like, I'm surprised. I feel surprised all the time at, you know, which students I maybe had, like, really high hopes for who don't do any creative things at all. And then students who really struggled. And I think because, like, I feel like when I was a student, I sometimes was a student who struggled with certain things. I try not to ever, like, make assumptions about the students who struggle. Mm-hmm. I more likely will make assumptions about the students who do great and expect them to keep doing great. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I am just surprised and interested about what they end up doing, like what they end up pursuing. So it's kind of cool.
Right.
So I like to talk on this podcast about the creative development and like artistic identity development of my guests. And I feel like that's best done by starting at the beginning. Yeah. So I'd love to hear what you were like as a creative child, what were kind of the early manifestations that you were creative or were bound to be creative. And then I'd also like to kind of talk about what the creative environment was like in your childhood.
Well, yeah, my mother encouraged all of us to do something musical. There are four kids. I grew up in Northern California.
Okay.
And I started out at 6 years old, taking piano lessons from the neighbor across the street.
Okay.
And at the age of, I think it was 8 or 9, I accompanied in my first school concert.
What?
I accompanied the chorus. I played Edelweiss. I still remember.
Still kind of have it in the muscle memory.
Yeah. And that's how a lot of my school experience started out, was in playing the piano and accompanying for school choruses.
So were you like, did your piano teacher feel like you were a bit of a star? Like, was your piano teacher like, wow, she's really progressing quickly?
I don't have a lot of memories of that. You know, as a child, you're kind of, at least I was pretty naive as to what it all meant. And I didn't know what it meant to be good or talented or not.
Of course.
I just did.
I don't know what those things mean, but I do kind of feel like if you're little and you're just trying something and you happen to be kind of, you know, you're just enjoying it. And then the adults around you are saying you're kind of extra good at this, that might be something that could really, for better or worse, kind of set a bit of a path.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if, you know, just thinking about the age you started and then the age at which you were playing, you know, publicly, whether there's like an implication that you are kind of advancing quickly.
That did start to show up, I guess, a little bit later. I can say some of my earliest memories, even from where I was living, was when I first came home from school every day. It was like, set the kitchen timer for 30 minutes. You have to practice before you do anything else. And I was a precarious and rather social as a young child.
Yeah.
And my first priority was wanting to go out and play. So initially I saw that as an interruption to all of it. But in my later years too, it's like my siblings' musical pursuits died out rather early. And
are you the youngest, did you say?
I'm the second to oldest.
Okay, second to oldest. Okay.
They might have studied, like my older brother did trumpet, younger brother did violin, and my sister also did piano. But it didn't really stick with any of them. And many years later as an adult, I asked my mother, why?
Yeah.
Why did you continue to encourage me? You know, my parents were not the type to really profusely compliment, so I didn't always know what they were thinking. But I consistently studied throughout all my childhood, and I would change teachers as my abilities warranted. And
that's huge.
Yeah. And then as you know, probably when I was 11 or 12, I started doing even more accompanying. I had a friend that knew I played and she was like, the teacher is looking for someone. Might want to come in and play. And that's where it initially launched off. And
a voice teacher was looking for an in-lesson accompanist?
No, it was for a chorus.
Oh, okay.
And so my musical journey really began at the keyboard.
Okay.
And I didn't really take my first voice lessons, my first formal voice lessons until I was in college.
Okay.
I was lucky enough, through my piano experience and through my high school experience, I had wonderful mentors that really encouraged me and noticed my singing and wanted to bring me out from behind the keyboard. So
how did they notice your singing?
I just auditioned for different things.
Okay.
From time to time. And,
so you were accompanying, but also like in the choirs and in musicals, maybe.
In the musicals, I was always behind the keyboard and they were careful to say, please do what you want to do. We could really use you here, but we want you to do what you want to do. But I always just went behind the keyboard. I think I was a little bit shy of the stage at that.
So crazy at that age. Think about that. Like, to think about how much change happens, in like your 20s, that's such a big, so I have maybe a couple other questions about these kind of developmental times. And, I say this on the podcast all the time, but part of the reason I'm interested in it is because I think our culture is very confused about talent.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to hear professional artists talk about the fact that more often than not, I think our talent doesn't show up in our childhood.
Yes.
It doesn't mean that you're not creative. I feel like when I hear professional creatives reflect on their childhood, we get these like beautiful tidbits of like what the beginning of that creativity actually looked like versus, what we might think from the movies, which is like, prodigies exclusively. That's what we see. And, that's pretty much it.
Right.
One of my other questions is, aside from music, were you like dabbling in any other creative things like drawing or writing or even just, the way that you would consume media or how you were interacting with friends? Like, when you think about the origins of your creativity, does any of that kind of beginning building blocks start outside of music?
I grew up in the 60s and 70s, so how we consumed media was very different.
Yeah.
It just was not as available.
Yeah.
I had a little AM radio on my dresser that I would play. It was vinyl LPs or 45s. Yeah. I had my little portable record player. Yeah. So in the consumption of it, we were all on the same track that way. And even to go back and listen, I've been listening to this Sirius XM channel that was music from like my high school years. Cool. And I'm like, oh, that was so awful. Yeah. But I knew it all. Yeah. But it was like all this out of tune kind of,
I know.
It was just like the quality of it was just not
really poor.
It was really poor. It was really not good. But that was that was the culture that I grew up in. And I think a lot of it was just in what I was experiencing in school and in church and with friends and,
just think like creative thinking.
Right. Yeah. Right.
That's my favorite answer. Yeah.
When I started college, there's a fellow that went to school with, his name was, Bill Schumann. He goes by William. He's a very famous voice teacher actually in New York, has been there for many years now, but he was one of my cohorts at BYU.
Okay.
And I remember him talking about all these artists that he loved and recordings that he'd listened to and have you heard of this, that, or the other. And I was oblivious to all of it and hadn't consumed any of it up to that point. So
I had a similar experience when I went to college, like oh, I have missed everything. You know? Even like when I was growing up, music was easier to get a hold of, but not that much easier. Like YouTube came out my freshman year of college. So when I was like in my childhood, it was still like you have to go to a store and hope that the CD you want is there. And a lot of it was just the radio. So, I mean, there was definitely some more advocacy, but still no iTunes, you know, like,
Very, very different. Yeah.
Well, and even like when iTunes was new, like not all music was on there. like I think it's just a given kind of now that if something is released, it's going to be there. And back then, like even a lot of new releases weren't on iTunes, and certainly older releases were likely not. Like, I mean, most jazz music wasn't on iTunes even until I was in grad school, you know?
Right.
Because people were like, what is this?
Like, right.
I mean, no one was putting like Billie Holiday's old recordings on iTunes. It just like hadn't happened.
Right. So, right.
Anyway. Okay. I have two more questions about your pre-college years. One is, what was your, to the best of your memory, what was your relationship like with music? So I mean, you're playing, but like in terms of like what it meant to you in kind of an internal way, or maybe how you were hearing it, or do you remember anything about what your relationship was like with music in general?
Absolutely. I think, you know, I look at a lot of, you know, even now I have the advantage of retrospect. With my high school cohorts, now we're on Facebook, so we kind of see how each other's lives have turned out. But music was really an anchor for me. I look back to it at that time. It was something that I knew that I was good at. It helped to quantify my self-worth and my self-identity. All my social circles developed out of music, and it was my way of getting validation, I guess, when you're an insecure young person. But I didn't always look at it as validating, but something secure that I could hang on to that helped to define me.
Yeah.
Like if someone wanted to know me, I didn't feel like they really did unless they heard me sing or were involved in some element of that aspect of my life.
I've heard similar answers from so many of my guests. And again, it's like, I'm fascinated by these questions of creative development and identity development because they're, you know, intermingled, but they're not always the same. Because the way that, you know, the way that we are conceiving of our identity and the way that, you know, we interact with others might be very different from like our private relationship with these things. So I actually have one follow-up question before I have the big second question. When you're thinking about music, maybe not in terms of your playing, but just in terms of like, you know, appreciating the music itself, like when you're taking your own kind of abilities out of it, do you remember what your relationship was like with that? So maybe more just like, you know, what you felt like listening to the music that was being played or that you were helping to participate in, or, you know, like in less of a relational to other people kind of a way, like what, do you remember anything about how you felt about just what kind of hearing music and making music like meant?
Right. It helped to provide a vehicle to express what I was feeling.
Okay.
It's the biggest part of it. So, I mean, many of my solo opportunities came out of church. So, you know, it was through a medium of sacred music. But whenever I was able to find a piece of music that I really resonated with, it's like that was my way of expressing it without knowing otherwise how to do it. It was just because it, you know, it was so heart connective. And all the pieces were there, you know, when the music was added to the equation, that if it were just the words themselves, it wouldn't have
had
totally
evocative
had that effect on me.
I have felt and articulated similar things. And I think for me, especially like singing Broadway music in particular, let me, you know, start to work through some like bigger, like darker things that I was maybe going through that would have been totally taboo to say or to write about,
yeah,
or to draw about. But you know, when I'm singing, you know, I dreamed a dream, like mm-hmm. I might be even as like a, you know, a 14-year-old, like experiencing a bit more of certain types of grief and betrayal, mm-hmm. Than maybe some kids my age, but I got to kind of like express them through this character without anybody maybe knowing like
right.
that I was maybe,
for sure.
I was maybe attaching to like certain lines in rather than just the fact of singing this iconic piece, you know,
right.
that it
right.
was really kind of, I was really kind of meaning more of it. So yeah, I think it really can be, I don't know, like a safe way to like start to express things. And I think a lot of art is that way for a lot of young people and maybe even especially young women.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think with young women too, and I mean, depending on the environments they grew up in too, is there's just a different expectation and of how to conform,
right.
of how to be expressive.
Like things have to be pretty and beautiful.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And the deep, dark other side of things, yeah. it's like, we're just, let's just
yeah.
put that away or let's put that off in the corner. And what's so powerful. And I think particularly about what I've noticed about a lot of more contemporary musical theater over the last 20 years or so, they are
yeah.
implementing. I think like,
Dear Evan Hansen.
I love that show.
I was trying to guess where you're
honestly,
going.
Honestly, I love that show. But one of the places I see that starting or really opening was with shows like Rent.
Yeah.
Right? Where there really were the darker sides of things.
Yeah.
And it becomes powerful because it's the human experience.
Yeah.
And people resonate with the human experience. And, you know, whenever there's that feeling of connection, that someone else has been through that too. That was right. someone else's, they went to that dark place where I thought only I did, but someone else experienced this too. And it just,
yeah.
it connects us as human beings.
Totally. Well, and I think it's a great, I mean, again, I say this all the time, but I think it's a great, it helps you work your empathy muscle.
Yes.
Like, you know, when we're singing these pieces about these, you know, from the perspectives and about these fictional characters, they aren't real people, except that those emotions ring true. And, you know, grief is grief is grief. And mm-hmm. Betrayal is betrayal is betrayal. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. So, you know, understanding that, like, if you're singing something from Rent and maybe like you're homophobic or something.
Right.
Understanding that these, like when these emotions are articulated in such a poignant way that rings true, I have to think it gets your brain going like,
yes.
oh, that person feels the same things as me.
Mm-hmm.
And even something as, you know, kind of potentially small as, you know, having seen or sung something from a musical like that might get you thinking differently about a totally different kind of person.
For sure.
Yeah. And then, okay. So my second question is, how did you decide, like, when did you choose a major? Like I want to kind of know about when you were choosing, when you were leaving high school, what were you kind of thinking about what you might do?
To me, there was no question
okay.
that I was going down a musical path. I didn't know what that was going to look like. I started for a semester as a piano major and then...
Piano performance is a different thing.
It's a different deal and it's so isolating for one.
Yeah.
And I was not the perfectionist at the keyboard. I mean, since so much of my experience had been in accompanying, I mean, I was used to following and adjusting and...
It's more kind of... alive and living and breathing.
Yeah. And I was, you know, fortunate enough to just to get in, as you know, very early on in my freshman experience, being really, you know, taken into the choral program particularly. And cool. Then it just kind of grew from there. But there was, I never had any idea that I would do anything else. I didn't know how that would show up exactly, but I knew that I was on a musical path. I started out in music ed, and I actually did finish a degree in music ed. But I added some extra on, and I got an additional specialty in pedagogy. And here's kind of an interesting, just an interesting little story about how that developed and evolved. Because I was approaching my semester of student teaching, and I had auditioned for the opera. I mean, I used to just audition for so many things, and I didn't know how it would affect other things I was doing. Yeah. I just wasn't always aware.
Yeah.
And I got cast in a primo role. Opera yeah. role. I was, wow. We were doing Don Giovanni. I got cast as Donna Elvira. It was one of the best roles at BYU. Okay. Was one of the best roles had been offered up to that point. Yeah. And it was really a good opportunity for me. But my music ed advisor said, if you're going to student teach, you can't do the opera at the same time. You need to be focused on your student teaching. So you need to make a choice.
Okay. And you picked the opera?
I did.
Yeah, good. Yeah. Of course
I did pick the opera. And the opera was performed in the spring. And so I made the decision then that I, you know, was going to take all my other qualifying courses for vocal pedagogy. Then in the fall semester, I student taught, and I kind of just finished it up all together.
So I had
all of those elements.
I would love to hear your thoughts on what it was like starting voice lessons. Cause that's, I mean, I can see that being like, I can see that being a little emotional, like, you know, maybe you're feeling like you're starting late or something. So I'd love to hear about like what your experience was like diving into having your individual voice like worked with.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd also love to talk about like what it was like getting into kind of like opera, because I assume that might have been also new.
Yes. Yeah, it was pretty new. I did a little bit of that in high school. I was fortunate enough to have had two choir teachers who were both really fine singers.
Okay.
And so when it came time to do things like solo and ensemble, they would, you know, pick out solos for us, and they would coach us and help prepare us and get us ready. So I did have that
a little bit
of feedback. Yeah. My very first teacher at BYU was Colleen Harris, and she was just a little, well, she wasn't little, but she was just this spitfire, a very positive energy, very, just very outgoing, very nurturing. And I was with her for a year, but then I knew I wanted to be pushed more.
Yeah.
And I was very curious, and, one summer I was playing for a friend of mine's voice lessons, and she was studying with a teacher whose name was Terry McCombs at the time. And he was just delving into different things with her. And I thought, it just got me curious. And I asked him, would you mind, you know, can I take a few voice lessons with you? And
this is outside of school.
And I think we were just like in a summer term or something.
Okay.
So it was like nobody else was around
but he was
adjunct. Yeah. Okay. He was an adjunct faculty member at the time. And he listened to me a bit, and he said that, I want you to sing for my teacher, whose name was Ray Arbizu. And he was,
what a cool name,
rather legendary. He was Basque.
Okay.
Man, and a very recognized dramatic tenor.
Okay.
And had sung a lot of opera, and from that time forward, I worked with Ray Arbizu, and that was where I felt myself really pushed me. He saw my potential. He stretched me.
Yeah.
And, and I started competing from pretty early on.
Wow.
And he just took it right into me. And I did some difficult difficult repertoire, like for a 19 or 20 year old.
Yeah.
And, but what was interesting to me at the time, as I look back on it, was I didn't look at it as being hard. They just asked me to do it. And I just said, okay, I'll try this.
I always felt like that when I was younger too. Like,
I didn't know enough to know that it should be hard or that things the music was asking of me were beyond my ability to do it. I just tried and it worked.
Did you feel, were you kind of like, you know, at the top of the studio, like fairly quickly? Like, I know those things are hard to quantify, but like just from your, did you feel like I'm kind of doing very well?
It took a little bit of time. I'll tell you, I was with Ray Arbizu for about, I want to say it was the end of my sophomore year. We had a guest clinician come in. His name was Richard Miller, and he's been gone for a number of years now. And many of the people I'm telling you about have long since passed away. But Richard Miller was a well-known pedagogue and internationally known pedagogue who taught at the Oberlin School. And I had been given the opportunity to sing on this masterclass.
Okay.
And I still remember that time. I have very vivid memories of just being as nervous as I had ever been to do anything in my life, almost to the point of just being sick to my stomach. And I don't ever remember being that nervous before or since in anything I've done. But he pulled some really amazing sounds out of me, like things that I didn't know that I could do. And, all of the voice faculty was in the room and, prominent member, my cohorts,
all your peers,
all my peers. And that was when I really started getting attention.
Okay.
In terms of what just being more involved. It felt great from the standpoint. It's just like, because you always get to that point where you think that you're on a right track at some point and you just need that validated or you need that feeling of just being recognized in some way, being validated that you're on the right track, you're doing the right things. And that was that big moment of shift for me as an undergrad.
I don't know that I've ever experienced that. I feel like I'm always like, am I okay? Is this right? like, to this day, because I don't think I've ever been like, the shiny student. I think I'm like, I always think of myself more like the tortoise, just like steady and determined and like a little scrappy maybe. But yeah, I mean, I was at North Texas, which is very competitive and there's a lot of talent there.
Right.
So it's easy to kind of,
well, and when you're in, I think a place like BYU, there's a real strong cultural element there too.
Yeah.
And I think that fed into it as well. And, I know North Texas is huge.
Yeah. It's big.
And, and so culturally there has to be a different.
Although I have told this to a couple of people and I don't know. I'd be curious to know if you like specifically were aware that this was like a thing that was happening. But, cause I auditioned for vocal performance at BYU, as out of high school. And I got a letter saying that, I was like the 300th choice out of, 500 auditions.
I hated that. I just tell you,
that was a thing you were aware of that was happening?
Yes. Yeah. They did the rankings. I hated that.
Yeah. So honestly, the letter that I got said, you're not in the program and you're never getting into this program. And so you really should pursue other avenues.
Well, I hated that, honestly. Yeah,
it's really stressful.
And I had a number of students and I think they were pretty close about the same time I was working with you, that were close to making it, but didn't quite. I mean, it's like, she was like the little engine that could, and she tried and she tried and she tried.
Yeah.
It was so interesting to me because she, was close, but just not, didn't seem to be quite within her grasp. Well, interesting thing was we had a conversation about there's a decision to be made here.
Yeah.
It's like you need to decide if the BYU experience is more important or if you really pursuing your dream as a vocalist is more important.
Yeah.
Because you will get in somewhere else.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So so we had that conversation and she ended up going to SUU.
Yeah.
And she did her undergrad at SUU and came back actually to BYU as a graduate student.
Yeah, crazy. Well, and I taught there for 4 years, which is just, right.
it's a crazy thing to think about.
But yeah.
And she went on to get a doctorate from Indiana University. So,
it's crazy.
It's just, you just, that was just kind of the culture of that at the time. And I had so little to say about how the protocol was run, but
it didn't at all feel right.
It didn't at all feel right.
Well, it's students that age are too young to be like, to have anybody shut the door on anything.
Yeah.
But I don't know if I've said this for, you know, my listeners, but you know, I talk all the time about how pursuing our, you know, passions in these ways sometimes demand a lot of scrappiness and, that year that I took lessons from you for the listeners, I paid you out of pocket. I mean, it wasn't with a class. It wasn't part of my tuition. I had a full ride at BYU because I had good grades. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the reason I went there for that year before going to North Texas because my parents didn't want to help me. They only wanted me to go to BYU. Mm-hmm. So I thought I'll go to BYU, spend no money, work, save a lot of money, do as many generals as I can, and go to, and then go to UNT. I paid Anna, I think you were charging $100 an hour back then. That's what I remember. No, it was maybe more like $100 for every two lessons or something.
So, well, I thought about this not long ago. I haven't raised my lesson rates for probably 15 years.
Really?
So yeah, at the time I think I was charging $35 a half an hour.
Okay. Yeah. So $70 an hour. And so, I think I was taking hour lessons, but I just, you know, it's an evidence of how important it was to me because I was working at the BYU call center and using my like little income to take voice lessons, to prepare for my whole goal was to prepare for that North Texas audition. And then I got scholarships there. So it's just an interesting thing to kind of remember, like, you know, to keep, to be a little scrappy, maybe to kind of keep figuring it out. Mm-hmm. So tell me what happened, like, you know, after this, you finished up, your degree and the pedagogy specialization. And then what happened?
I, taught school for a year. I was at Cedar City High School. They had a teacher that was on a year sabbatical and I took his place for that year and got my, you know, my feet wet with teaching. And the first year is always for anybody that's taught.
Exhausting. I mean, It's terrifying.
Yeah. It's, you know, your first time of doing anything. And, but when the year was over, I left Cedar City. They did offer me, interestingly enough, they offered me another job. My job was a split job in teaching academics half day and music half day.
Okay.
And the music teacher was coming back, but I was teaching academics at the junior high school and the principal there offered me a job teaching academics. And one of the orchestra teacher told that principal, she said, there's no way she's going to stick around here for that.
Yeah, yeah.
As I was young, you know, just newly graduated. After that, you know, I'll tell you, just to back up a little bit,
please.
I graduated mid-year.
Okay.
And so the next semester, I actually did start my graduate degree.
Okay.
I did one semester of my graduate work. And then the next year is when I taught school. And when I came back from that, I thought, well, maybe I should keep trying this a little bit. And I applied for a few jobs, but kind of underneath, I was kind of half-heartedly applying, thinking, if I don't get these jobs, then I'll go back to graduate school.
Yeah.
Which I did.
Was your grad degree in ed again or in performance now?
I actually started in education. Okay. But my heart just wasn't in it.
Yeah.
And I'll always be grateful because when I decided to make that shift from music ed into performance, my music ed advisor, who was Gordon Jessup at the time, just said, let's just do it. I mean, this is obvious that this is where your heart is. And so he just released me. In fact, he released me from some difficult projects mid-semester because he said, you're not going to pursue this, so there's no point.
Yeah. Cool.
And so I got on the, you know, performance track.
Great. And then I would love, like, I don't know that much about like what happened in your career. I would love for you to just tell me what happened.
For sure.
And then I'll ask questions.
Yeah. Well, I initially, once I finished my master's degree, I had an interest in doing professional choral singing.
Okay.
And there was a group in the Twin Cities area, Minneapolis area, that was becoming quite well known at the time. It was called the Dale Warland Singers.
Okay.
They came to BYU. They were invited on a performance series, and I made contact with them before they came and requested an audition.
Cool.
And I didn't realize at the time how unusual that was, but I was later to find out that they did
That's awesome.
But I auditioned for a couple of different professional choirs. One was in Los Angeles, the LA Master Chorale, and the other one was the Dale Warland Singers. And I'm a Western girl. You know, I grew up in California. Like, going to LA would have been a very comfortable, easy transition for me at the time. But there was something really intriguing to me just about, I mean, I knew nothing about the Midwest.
You had a sense of adventure.
I did.
Yeah.
I did.
I get it.
Yeah. And so, you know, I got accepted into both groups. But you know, ultimately I received a contract from LA, but I hadn't heard anything from Minneapolis. And so I called the assistant director, who I feel like I could better kinda call her than the conductor. And she, at the other end of the phone, I can still remember, she says, you mean nobody's contacted you yet? And I said, no. And she said, don't do anything.
Yeah.
Don't do anything yet. And within a very short period of time, I got a contract from them.
Were you married at this time?
No.
I would love to hear you talk about what that, I don't know, like what you kind of had to like maybe go through as like an LDS woman, especially in that time, to like move back east single. Like, I have to imagine that there was pushback on that. Maybe not.
No, I mean, I just, you know, my parents were super supportive.
Okay.
And I look at it back at it now, at how little I was living on. I still can't believe I was living on that little.
Yeah.
But so I was in the Minneapolis area for 12 years.
Okay.
And I you know, started out with the Dale Warland Singers. And then my second year, I had a church job, you know, initially when I went there. And then I got a job teaching.
Okay. At a like private lessons or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I was at a, like I was a at a Bible college.
Okay.
And at a small Catholic university, I had an adjunct job, St. John's University in Collegeville, Minnesota.
When you say you had a church job, do you mean conducting, accompanying?
Yeah, I was conducting a choir at a Methodist church.
Okay, cool.
So I did that for, it was two
or three.
You had
these kind of three jobs. You were working for the choir, you were conducting at the church and teaching adjunct at, at a couple of places.
Right.
Okay.
I was doing like kind of living the gig life.
The freelance.
The freelance life.
Yeah.
And then I kept on doing the ensemble singing for a long time. I did do that, but I evolved more and more into my teaching. My third year there, I got a job at St. Olaf College in Northfield, which has an incredible music program. And interestingly enough, after my other experience, that's where I teach now.
Oh, cool.
As I ended up going back there. But I was there for 5 years initially. I started work on a doctorate.
Okay. Again, in vocal performance?
Yes.
Okay.
And at the University of Minnesota. and I, which I never did finish, which we'll go into the marriage story.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I'm dying to know just like what it was like from your perspective, you know, I don't know very many women like in your age group who have a similar story, like from our kind of LDS background. Like, mm-hmm. did you feel like you were kind of like alone? Like, were you one of the only women?
Well, yeah, in all those ways. But, you know, I felt really fulfilled in what I was doing.
I mean, and it's awesome.
And I mean, the sense of adventure that you're talking about, I mean, I was always kind of looking for the next thing.
Did you feel brave about it? Like, were you feeling like how you were having to overcome fear, or was it kind of just like, this feels great, this is what I want to do?
Okay, well, this is the next thing. Because okay. I'll tell you, my last year at St. Olaf College, I'd interviewed for a full-time, because I was not quite full-time, but I wanted a tenure track position, okay. which the one I was in was not.
Okay.
And when I didn't get that tenure track position, I, just through the grapevine, it was interesting. I taught at a summer program, with a fellow who called me up one day and said, we have an opening at Bemidji State University, which is in northern Minnesota, north central Minnesota. And we just got the funding for it. He was looking for ideas of people.
Cool.
And so I said, well, I'll give it a try.
Yeah.
And I was the last of four applicants four final applicants for that position.
Cool.
And not long after my interview, they had me wait in another room. And about a half hour later, they came back and they offered me the job.
Wow. Kind of like on the spot. That's
on the
crazy.
On the spot. Yeah. So, cool. Yeah. So, it was a much smaller faculty. It was in a beautiful setting, albeit the winters just in Minnesota are cold.
Rough. Yeah.
But I was there for, I was there for 4 years.
Okay.
And this is where the marriage part of it kind of came into it. Early on in my fourth year of teaching there, I started getting correspondence from a fellow that I had known at BYU.
Okay.
And he was going through a divorce, and I was on his radar. You know, we had always been friends, but never dated. Well, we kind of went out a couple of times, and it was like, oh, well, okay.
Okay, yeah.
And, but we started communicating a lot, and before too long, he proposed to me. And, okay. and my unfolding with that story, so it was, I was not too far from finishing my doctorate.
Okay.
But, you know, he had five children from his first marriage, wanted to be where his children were, which I, you know, completely understood. And then, but then going back to Utah Valley was kind of, you know, I have a lot of family here.
Yeah,
so it was kind of like coming back home for me. And so, initially I thought, okay, I'm going to finish up some coursework over the summer, then I'll move back, et cetera.
Yeah.
But I got too impatient. I didn't finish my coursework. And I moved back in the spring.
How old were you?
Summer. I was 42.
Okay. Okay. Cool.
I was 42 at that time. Or actually 40. Yeah. I was just barely 42.
Did you have any grief about leaving your doctorate, or did you kind of feel like you're just looking forward?
I was just looking forward, really, because, cool. you know, we had this whole thing worked out, excuse me, where I would continue to teach.
At BYU?
At BYU.
Okay.
I had interviewed for a different position than from the one I actually ended up getting.
Okay.
But still, it, you know, I was still teaching pretty much full time.
Okay.
And he had full time job with benefits. My job didn't come with benefits, but we had just worked.
It was
all of that out. Okay. And, I thought, well, I'll just, in the back of my mind, it was just like, well, I'll find a way to figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just had never really completely given up on the idea, but it was just like, this is what is here right in front of me right now. Yeah. And so I was married for 6 years.
Okay.
And it was right. It was the time that I was working with you, I think, when I went through my divorce.
Yes, I remember that.
And
I didn't know anything about it, but I do remember you were like going through a divorce right then.
Yeah. Well, he ended up coming out.
Okay.
And so
it's such a common story.
It's amazing how common it is and how some of my dearest women friends now have that shared experience in common. Because I mean, particularly at that particular time, that was just what you did.
Yeah.
That was what was in the culture and you pushed forward and and you did that. So
6 years, that's like, so if I can I ask, like, how did it feel like making all these kind of big changes and then, you know, changing again, like such a short time later?
I'll tell you, it's really hard to find the words because it's like your life just cracks open and it's the what do I do now?
Yeah.
And for me, I was that particular year, like he literally walked out of the marriage right before the school year started.
Oh no.
And I had, they had asked me later on in the summer to fill a 1-year replacement position for a professor that had decided to retire early.
Yeah.
So
that year, 2006?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was fall of 2006.
Yeah, that's when I started.
It happened the end of that summer. And so I was a bit of a wreck and trying to...
That's crazy.
Prepare courses that I hadn't taught before and not really being able to wrap my head around it. And fortunately, my Arden Hopkin, who is the head of the Voice Area, I shared my situation with him and he was very supportive. He was kept it very much between us. So it was not common knowledge really to many people at all. But he kind of helped me push ahead, you know, through that time.
Well, I would love to just say that as a student that was your student that year and only that year, and I think you probably knew that it was only going to be that year. It could have been easy for you to not invest in me, but I really felt like you did invest in me and were very attentive and thoughtful with how you were teaching me. And I think that probably really just speaks to what kind of a teacher you are, that in, you know, maybe one of the worst years of your life, most complicated years of your life, you were, you know, that careful with your students.
Oh, so, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
It's interesting to hear that in retrospect, when you're just trying to keep it together.
Yeah.
And, but I truly, I mean, that was my solace in a lot of ways, was being able to invest in and, nurture my students. Like the year after, and because you had left, I'm not sure that you knew this.
Yeah.
I continued to teach at BYU 1 year after that. I went back to, you know, being part-time. And then, I had an opportunity to go to BYU Hawaii.
Yeah. I did know that you were there. I didn't know how quickly you had gone there, but
yeah. So fall of 2008, I started, at BYU Hawaii and, many pros and cons into that experience. And, just suffice it to say that, I ended up leaving because I felt like I had to.
Okay.
I won't get into the
Academia is very complicated, I think church-owned academia is extra complicated.
Extra complicated. As you know.
I do. I do know.
You're familiar with that. There's that line, that really fine line between being ecclesiastical and being professional and academic. No. And those lines were so incredibly blurred where I was. Anyway,
you just mean like your kind of like academic integrity was like it was hard to be the kind of teacher you wanted to be?
Well, there was just a lot of interpersonal drama.
Okay.
And people not willing to acknowledge bad things that were happening.
Sure.
And there, gross. You know, was a bit of homophobia, yeah. And I spoke out against the homophobia, yeah. And almost lost my job. I was on my way out before that, yeah. Became a real issue anyway.
That's the same thing that happened to me. I taught at BYU for 4 years and was an advocate for, I had that first year that I was directing Jazz Voices, 7 out of the 12 of my singers were gay.
Not surprising. Not yeah. Surprising. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I have a hard time remembering exactly who the personnel, but when I look back at it might've been like between the first semester and between my first and third semesters. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, maybe it wouldn't have been 7 out of 12 exactly at one point, but a very high yes. percentage. And yes. if I were to look at over the course of the 4 years, how many of my students were gay, it was a lot.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I was pretty supportive openly for that. Mm-hmm. And I started getting, I would call it harassment from my employers. Mm-hmm. Kind of to an extreme degree. Mm-hmm. And then, my bishop threatened to pull my ecclesiastical endorsement for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's probably same thing that happened
yes.
to you.
Yeah. 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 I mean, very similar. And like I say, by that time, I had already found another job.
Okay.
It was just, I needed to teach you the summer
yeah.
and finish out my contract. And so
yeah.
it would have done them very little good to
yeah.
get rid of me at that time, because they still needed somebody to do what I was doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, there were many things
that's
besides
really
that
hard. I don't know if, I mean, I'm, you know, going through that kind of experience, younger and without having had, I don't know, other success really. That was my first academic job. And it still really affects my confidence.
It can.
Yeah.
And it's academia is a really twisted world. And it's I ended up going back, as I mentioned before, to St. Olaf College. Yeah. I've been there now since returned there the fall of 2014, and actually wanted to go back there because I just remember it as being such a supportive environment.
Beautiful place, yeah.
And supportive from a collegial perspective and supportive of the students. I mean, it's very liberal.
Yeah.
So I felt much more comfortable because I have, you know, openly worked with trans students as they've gone through their transition as vocalists, and gay students, bisexual students, lesbians. I mean, just kind of covered the gamut.
Yeah.
And it was never a deterrent or never an issue for these students. They just were who they were and were free to be able to express themselves as who they were.
Yeah, yeah.
And a very few of them ever took it to an extreme measure. I mean, they didn't have an axe to grind. They just wanted to sing.
Yeah.
So, it was not a political statement for many of them. It's I just want to sing.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And,
it should be simple like that.
So, yeah.
I would love to hear you talk about, I know you do energy work and I want to talk about that stuff too, but first I'd love to talk about, I'd love to hear you just reflect on what you love about your craft, and you can talk about singing and teaching pedagogy. You know, what feels creative about it? What are the kind of special things that you wish people understood about just what you know and what you do? Mm. Just anything you want to talk about or reflect on of, either singing or teaching singing, just that you love about your job.
Well, thank you for the question. First of all, it's, This is a retrospective for me because I'm, I haven't formally announced this anywhere, but I'm anticipating retiring next year.
Okay.
And so I just finished my 37th year of teaching.
Wow.
And it's been an incredible ride. And my personal, what I've found too is, and I think we all find this as teachers, is that your personal evolution really coincides so much with what you do on a, you know, on a, the from the perspective of singing,
yeah,
because it's so heart related. It's just that release of, you know, as I have been stepping into this era of my life, it's less about having to prove myself and yeah. more about just,
what are the stories I want to tell?
What are the stories I want to yeah. tell? Being truthful.
Yeah.
And as I work with my students, my sincerest desire with my students is to help them release what's in them.
Yeah.
To help them open that part of themselves up through their instrument. And honestly, I don't care what it sounds like even yeah. initially. To me, that yeah. like the truth-telling aspect of it to me is actually the most important, because I've had many students come through my studio who won't do a thing yeah. when they go out into the world. I've also had, you know, lots of students who are, you know, making their marks as performers, as teachers, yeah. as, you know, and who are really making a difference.
Yeah.
In the music world, which is, you know, huge. Just is amazing
yeah.
and huge to see. So, from the standpoint of the, you know, the physical aspects of singing, the emotional aspects of singing, it's that vulnerable exposure of oneself.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, our voices are the most personal things.
Yeah.
Most personal expressive tools that we have.
I always say they're the means whereby we communicate ourselves, you know,
yeah, yeah,
and in so much more than words, you know, in all of those paralinguistic, you know, yeah, mannerisms.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, and, you know, I'm sure you've probably heard the saying that it's people will remember how you made them feel yeah. long after they remember how you sounded.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And that
I couldn't agree more.
And that, I mean, that to me is the fundamental, because I mean, I'm just sitting here just kind of,
I know, I feel it too.
Getting chills, because yeah. it's, I mean, that's how we make our mark in the world. It's, you know, improving lives through, you know, just through a really beautiful medium.
Yeah.
And enlarging the capacity for connection, because music ultimately, it's a fundamental thing that connects us all.
Yeah.
And when we resonate, like music is vibration, right?
Yeah, yeah. So it's embodied.
It's embodied and it's absorbed.
Yeah.
And it's something that the body doesn't forget.
Yeah.
It
yeah.
just, the body just stores those memories and even those experiences that, you know, that the experiences that I had as a singer, you know, just even, we've talked more about my teaching, and not as much about my singing, but, in my later career, I just have focused more, you know, I still have sung, but I've focused more on my teaching. That's just, that's where my path led. And I just felt much more excited about that aspect.
I get it. I love it. Teaching too.
You know, from that side of it. But you know, every person has something to give us along the way.
Yeah.
And as I've worked with students over the years, a lot of times I'll get really interesting stories from them about the backgrounds they've come from or the things that other people have told them. And some of them sound kind of farcical, you know, just as a teacher, just kind of hearing their interpretation of the story.
Sure.
And, I have come to the point, and actually did long ago, where it's like, I'm hearing their aspect of the story, but I don't know what the teacher's story is. I don't know the context of how, because we want to assume no teacher wants to do damage.
Right.
No teacher wants to, you know, provide a negative experience for the students. So you have to believe, or at least I do, that they're doing the best they can in the circumstance where they are with what they know.
Yeah.
And maybe they don't have the developed knowledge or vocabulary or whatever it is to communicate what they're, what they would really like to be able to do.
Yeah.
So most people believe on what, in what beautiful sound is,
yeah,
and what it takes to make a healthy, vibrant sound.
Yeah.
So to me, it's been, you know, honing my vocabulary and trying to find the language to communicate what I mean. Right. And I'm also, I also rely heavily on my intuition from the perspective, especially of when I work with a student, I, you know, kind of physically in my body take on their experience. You probably do the same thing.
It's just 100%.
Like you can imagine what it feels like. And that's how I solve, that's how I problem solve.
Yes. I was just talking about this with Andrew like 2 days ago. Like sometimes, cause I, you know, sometimes when I finish my teaching day and we're cooking dinner together, I'll say, you know, I was a really good teacher today. and what I mean when I say that is like, I did a good job of taking on the student's energy and like, that's what it feels to me to be a good teacher, to kind of meet them where they are and understand what they're going through so I can help them problem solve. Mm-hmm. And when I feel like I'm not a good teacher, it's on the days where like, I just try as I might, I'm not getting there.
Well, and it has a lot to do with how open the student's energy is.
Of course.
As well, for sure.
Yeah.
Because there are times when they're going to be resistant to you.
Yeah.
No matter what. And I think I could probably count on maybe one or two hands that if I could even remember students that I just haven't been able to crack that barrier. There's just been something there that's just, there's not been that connection made. And when you know that's happening, it's like, okay, I'm happy to encourage you to do what you feel like you need to do to find what you're looking for.
Yeah.
But the vast majority, you know, I'd say 99%. I haven't kept track of how many students or how many lessons many thousands of lessons I've taught over the years. But you can feel when that resonation has happened.
It's the best feeling.
And what always kind of makes me chuckle a little bit is when I'll go through the process with them and I'll say, and are you feeling? And then I'll name the certain thing and this is where you feel like it's going and this is where the struggle is or whatever.
Yeah.
And they look at me and they're like, how do you know that?
Yeah.
And well, I'm a singer too.
Yeah, totally.
And
I'm a person too.
So, right. But, you know, getting into the, like the intricacies of the vocabulary and, you know, just finding a way to just effectively communicate that with each student in their own way.
It's such a beautiful struggle.
Yeah.
I love it. I mean, I also talk with Anderson. So, you know, one thing that's maybe a bit different, most of my teaching experience has been in my private studio, which means that my students are generally less serious than college students would be. They may or may not take lessons for 2 months and then never again, you know? Mm-hmm. So sometimes I don't quite have 2 months is not enough time.
Right.
Especially if they're coming every other week, and are not already accomplished musicians in at least some way for me to kind of figure out what's going on sometimes. But, you know, so there's that and there's complications to be had with the temporary nature of it and the sometimes very parents and kids are not on the same page, you know, things like that. But one of my favorite things is when I look at my roster for the day and one of my students is a 12-year-old girl and one of my students is a 55-year-old man and one of my students is, you know, a 22-year-old man. The breadth of that creative experience from my perspective is so enriching and occasionally very exhausting.
Yes.
You know,
no doubt.
Yeah, to go from the kind of energy that I need to teach a man who's the same age as my dad, to teaching, you know, like a very shiny little girl.
Yes. Yes.
Sometimes absolutely.
That can be
a lot, but it's, but if I'm feeling fairly whole
as a person and I'm hydrated and I'm not too tired. Mm-hmm. It's a very exciting premise for a day. Mm-hmm. Do you remember anything about what I was like as a student? It was a long time ago.
It was, but I do, you know, I have to tell you that one of the things from a personal level that, I remember you saying, there's more than this. Yes. But, when you found out that I was going through a divorce at that time, how empathetic and supportive mm-hmm. you were. And, I just remember you saying, it's just us blondes, we stick together.
That's so funny.
I don't know why I remember that, but I do remember feeling that encouragement from you at a very difficult time. But one of the biggest things that strikes me about you as I look back to that time, you were really searching for something.
Yeah, I really was.
And wanting to find your place. And I knew that you had this other ambition that you wanted to fulfill and how important that was to you. But I mean, also that you worked really hard.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was something that you wanted and you weren't going to let anybody else tell you that you couldn't have that.
Yeah.
And so that's, I mean, but I know that it was a time of struggle and perseverance for you when you went through that. But that's, I remember most of all that even despite the pushback that you felt, that it was just like, I have this goal.
Gotta do it.
This is what I want to do. This is where my heart is. This is what I've always wanted. And I'm going to go do this.
Yeah. It feels like so much care to me that you remember any of that. Cause it really feels like it could have just been a blip, but yeah, certainly that's how I felt. So that's, you know, I sometimes struggle a lot with retrospect, because I mean, I think at that point in my life and in most of my 20s, probably I was confused about so many things. I was really confused about my parents and what it meant, like the way that they treated me, what it meant. Mm-hmm. And I was very confused about which kind of problems I was going to be able to solve. You know, I was confused about a lot of things, but I do remember feeling pretty focused on some things that I felt confident about.
Yes.
And feeling like the rest of it was very wishy-washy.
You know, I think, you know, for anybody who has that creative bent and, you know, when all these other things are kind of chaotic in your life and not seemingly settled or clear, I think when you have that creative bent, you have that thing that's meaningful to you that you really want to focus your energy on.
Yeah.
And when you have that one thing, and music was that for me as well. When you have that thing that you know is so intrinsically a part of you and so intrinsically makes you who you are. And, you know, it could have been that, you know, I'm not a psychologist, but this aspect of, you know, you sharing with your parents, it's like, with your voice, you had something that you wanted to say.
Yes,
you had something that you wanted to communicate and were really driven to do that at, you know, regardless of who was having it or not.
Mm. Yeah.
And that you knew.
It was just like a stubborn something.
That was your North Star, right? Yeah. That was kind of your North Star. That was the thing that was a defining point for you in your own identity at that point in your life.
Totally. Yeah. And felt like an anchor and felt like, I don't know, that makes sense. So like, we'll focus there.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's something I've been reflecting on a lot lately. You know, just as I've been kind of trying to pick up the pieces, I went no contact with my dad like a little over a year ago, and you know, just kind of officially and finally realizing like these are not things to be improved. Like these are not things that can be improved.
Yeah.
And kind of just thinking of like a beginning of like, well, I'm going to, you know, make a conscious choice from here on out in my life to surround myself with people who
like deserve to be in my life. And, and that feels like pretty, radical to me because I've spent a lot of time in my life with giving a lot of space to people who
I get it.
Shouldn't have been there probably.
I get it. Yeah.
And it feels new and I feel very like trying to figure it out. And it's been so weird as I've been thinking about my relationship with art and my relationship with music in particular. It is that kind of North Star still. And it's the one thing, like creativity, I would say, is the thing that I can most reliably like manufacture joy and manufacture energy from. Like it's a never ending well. Like it never disappoints me. It never stops giving. There's always more. I can always go there. But it's so fraught the way that like that relationship between me and the music is so pure. It's so positive. But like the delivering of that music to others is so complicated.
It feels
like this very perverse cycle where like my one true love is like locked up in all of this kind of these like triggering old scripts.
Well, it's in your DNA, you know, and it's, I admire, I mean, I've had not, from what I know of your personal background, it's not been as dramatic as yours was, but I've had some really difficult family relationships that where I've had to place the same
boundary
restriction and boundary. And that there's a price to be paid on either side of that.
Totally.
And it's always going to be a part of you, regardless if it's current in its energy, it's always going to be a part of you in some way. And you have to make that decision. You know, I had a therapist that told me, just said, that's you can't just pretend it's not there.
Totally.
It's just like, it's always in your, it's always
orbit, kind of.
Yeah, it's always in your. Yeah, that's a good word for it. It's
always you were doing this, and it just looked like that to me. I've been one thing, and you know, I say this all the time, but I feel so young. Like I feel like I'm 33, and I feel like I'm at the beginning of, I'm at the beginning of way more than I'm at the end of.
Yes.
And one lesson that I think I've learned, and I'm open to change. To changing my mind. But one lesson that I think I've learned is that, compartmentalizing these things doesn't work. No. I mean, I think I tried really hard to do that the first 30 years of my life.
Well, that's how you survive though.
Right.
To survive, you have to do that.
Right. And so, the thing that I'm kind of trying to do now is have this kind of radical acceptance and just kind of curiosity. Like, I know that I love making things. I know that when I take these things that I've loved making and share them, it's a minefield for me. But I, at this point, I kind of feel like, I don't know. It's just like, I got to figure it out. There's no stopping making things. That's not an option. And there's no stopping sharing things. Like, and it feels to me like if that kind of open-hearted, totally vulnerable, like it's exposed and it's sharing and it's really optimistic. I think every time you share something you've made, it's very optimistic and there's a lot of hope built in. If that, all of those beautiful things mean that there's like a higher risk for hurt, like, so be it. That's kind of how I feel.
And it, I mean, it always is. It's like, there's a phrase that I love in this, it's just called broken open.
Yeah.
And when you look at the, like some of the greatest composers of all time, like, you know, Brahms and Mahler and others, they were deeply disturbed, emotional people. And this is not, I mean, I'm not saying that this
I
is
am
you by any means.
Sometimes deeply disturbed.
So, but you listen to their music and you listen to like the angst and the longing and the, I mean, the things that comprise their music. And this is, you know, it's a reflection of our lived experience.
Yeah, totally.
And it's it's, you know, so long as we're here,
yeah,
that's what it's going to be. And from someone who is, I won't say I'm at the end, because I'm hoping to think that, that I've got a ways more to go.
I feel like you're in a middle.
But for someone who's traveled a bit further down that road, it just gets richer.
Yeah.
It gets deeper.
Yeah, good.
It gets fuller. And it's, you know, my one thing that I will say of these last kind of these last few years for me, because I'm in my early 60s now. It's a real transitional time in a person's life as you're entering that aspect of life, thinking, what do I really want? Who do I want to be?
Yeah.
Who do I want to be at this? You know, what have I been putting off? And one of the biggest things that I found in my own personal experience is that I don't want to hide anymore.
Yeah.
I want to say what I want to say. I want to be who I want to be and not apologize for it.
So cool and inspiring.
But I want to be compassionate and empathetic, yeah. But I also,
unabashed.
Yeah. Right. It's just like, I'm tired of living in an apologetic mode.
Totally
tired of living, in a way that causes me to, you know, regret a decision later.
Yeah.
When I knew, it's like, I had this feeling I should do something else, yeah. But I just didn't have the courage.
Yeah. It's like an unnecessary pain.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. But
yes.
But,
yeah. Yeah.
But just having the fortitude, I don't even know that, I guess more courage is required, but it's because I've just gotten to the point where I'm tired of the other stuff.
I was going to say, it's like, it's courage, but it's also just like, I have no more fucks to give,
yeah.
You know, or something. It's just like, I did that. I tried that. I played those games and yeah, I'm not doing it anymore.
I've done that. That's over.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's
I love it. I'm so inspired. I forget who I was saying this to. I was just talking about this to someone within the last week, but I'm so inspired by women who are about twice my age. This, I feel like maybe it's always been happening and I'm just noticing it for the first time, but I feel like something very interesting is happening with like women between, you know, the ages of 60 and 80. Like mm-hmm. I just feel mm-hmm. like there is this kind of like, we have no more fucks to give. Yeah. Like, and a cross section of like the age and the time we are in the world. And I have got my eye on women in that age group. Just, I don't know. I feel very inspired by women who are like about twice my age. Did you want to talk about the energy work? I mean, I'm assuming this is something that's, you're pouring a lot of your creativity into kind of this new medium.
Yes. Yes. I've been working with energy work. I was actually introduced to it by one of my students.
Cool.
Probably how long? It's been a little over 20 years ago. Could have been long. I think it was right about the time when it was almost 25 years ago when we worked together.
No, 15.
How old am I anyway?
I love it. Just to add a whole decade.
Just add a decade.
Yeah.
And just the idea of how that functioned and how that was working. And I had a couple of other friends who, when I was going through my divorce, were learning the medium that I practice in, which is... the name of it has been changed and I don't even remember what the name of it is now, but when I was doing it, it was called calico healing. But the sense of it is that you use muscle there's a protocol, but you use muscle testing to determine where energetic blocks are.
Okay.
And then you use a process called integration through breath to release, to release the blocks. And I love the intuitive nature of it. I do use the protocol sheet, but I'm really fluid with it because it's like whatever shows up, I just follow.
Yeah.
Because it can easily...
As you do as a voice teacher.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's the same process, yeah.
And one of the things I do there are a number of things that I do. I'm kind of known as the woo-woo teacher.
I love it.
Among some of the students, because I think the words we use matter.
Yeah.
And when we're trying to communicate something, the words we use matter. And so there's this little thing that we go by that in early studio classes in the semester we'll talk about. And that's because I will ask the student how something feels, and particularly if they're frustrated, how do you feel? And they'll give me the descriptors, whatever those descriptors are.
Okay.
And then I'll say, okay, so, but what do you want?
Yeah.
What do you want instead? What do you want? And if they say, I want to not feel this, or I want to not feel that, I want to not have my tongue be tense, I want to not have my breathing get stuck, I don't want my throat to be, so if it's like goes in the negatives,
yeah,
goes in those negatives, we talk about it a little bit and say, that's not okay, we understand that now, okay, we've acknowledged those things, so, but what we want to recognize is that the solution is not in the same space as the problem is,
right? Yeah, yeah.
So we have them restate it. So because oftentimes, and it still startles me, because oftentimes there's so much focus placed on the problem,
yeah,
that we don't even
think about what's
possible.
Beautiful feeling gonna be?
Yeah,
yeah.
What is really possible?
Totally.
And do they dare even state?
Yeah, because I want to feel free and exuberant and buoyant.
And helping them to just encouraging them to use the words to describe where they want to go. And what's so interesting to me at times, though, is that sometimes they don't feel like they can say it.
I know. I'm getting chills now, because like, I don't remember talking about this kind of stuff with you, but I do this in my teaching as well. Mm-hmm. And I'm frequently shocked by, the power of just like putting a name on a thing.
Yes.
But please continue.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. Because somehow there's this, I mean, particularly with singing, because it's so personal.
Yeah.
And they're just, we live in, I think particularly in Utah County, I just have to say my experience here, it's a shame-based environment.
Yeah.
And so to say that they're entitled to something, but I'm not saying this is exclusive to Utah County, because it is not.
It's happening in Texas, and it's happening.
It happens everywhere, but there just seems to be an interesting concentration of it, of it here. But to be able to say that I know I can sing beautifully, or I want to have this particular, I want to feel exuberance, I want to feel joy, I want to feel... Yeah. And what's the feeling that you'd like to have in your body? What would you like your throat to feel like?
And totally.
Awesome. Pedagogically. And I just kind of feed them words here and there to just kind of steer them. I never try to define it for them, but I do try to just help pull from them what I can tell they're trying to say, but don't give themselves permission to say.
I taught a lesson, a new student yesterday, she just could only afford one lesson. So she just came for one lesson. I was telling her, like, you're entitled to sing the way you want to sing. Mm-hmm. Like you own it already. Mm-hmm. Like it's in your body already. Like these beautiful sounds that you imagine yourself making, like they're already yours. And I really believe those things are also so powerful. Or even just, like you said, like the language that we say. I mean, I won't like really let my students say things like my tongue is, but to frame it like not like it's a thing that's happening to you, but I'm tending to move my tongue this way or, it has more advocacy in it and less kind of helplessness. Mm-hmm. Even just remembering like no one moves this tongue but you. And it doesn't mean it's your conscious mind in the way that you want it to be or that you have control, but your tongue does not have a mind of its own.
Like, right.
It
right.
simply does not. So
right.
if it feels that way, like that's a problem to solve, but
that can't be the end. I mean, if your premise is that your tongue has a mind of its own, this is an insurmountable problem.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But yeah, I really believe in those things as well. Like being very mindful about how we're framing things, what words we're putting on things. And yeah, thinking with kind of more of an abundance beginning default than like, let's get rid of these tensions and right. more just like, let's claim these beautiful things that we want.
Right.
That's awesome.
Because it's, you know, in thinking in energetic terms, I mean, in energy work is all about releasing the resistance to what could be.
Yeah.
You know, to the things you want. And singing, it's the same thing. Right. And you know, rechanneling, redefining the spaces that we use, the resonances we use, how the breath moves through the body, right. you know, just all of those things are sensations and bringing awareness to different sensations and how many of the changes, particularly once a singer has been studying for a while, many of the changes come just from those points of realization, and many of them are small. Many yeah. of them are not, or maybe they're moving their jaw when they just need to. Like I was working with a student yesterday, and actually as a trans student online, and he was trying to make the complete adjustment with his jaw, and all he needed was a little tweak of a lift.
Yeah, just
to
a open up his extra throat. Palate space.
Yeah,
or
just,
pharynx
just
space.
To open up his throat, yeah. and the breath just soared right through yeah. it, and it was just not an issue anymore.
Right.
And we look for the solutions usually as just being these jaw dropping moments of, and we love when those things happen because yeah. they happen too, but more often than not, it's
not Phantom of the Opera.
It's no, yeah. it's not a huge thing.
Yeah.
And I've always thought of it, it's just a paradigm for life. Singing is, it's just another way of channeling energy.
I was thinking about this when you were talking earlier about that your goal is to help the student kind of like be open and like have this kind of truth rather than any particular sound. And I think this is why, like, you know, not all of our students are going to be professional singers, but all of our students are going to keep being people. Mm-hmm. And if they have this, if we've helped them tap into this skill of telling the truth and, you know, maybe thinking a little bit more expansively about like, well, what are these options? Like, does it need to be this binary or does it need to be,
right.
That's such productive work.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And they can apply that same kind of, you know, mindset to mm-hmm. whatever they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, certainly other aspects of discipline beyond singing are the same,
yeah.
but singing is kind of special. It's especially
sure.
embodied.
For sure. Yeah. And there's that, you know, in my experience, some of the biggest rewards just come from those times where you see that shift in their eyes.
Yeah.
Like I had this, once he graduated, last year. He graduated and I had him from the time he was a freshman for 4 years.
Yeah.
I'd seen him in my studio every
yeah.
week. And I just love this young man. And, but he really expected a lot from himself. He was not a music major. He was, you know, he's going to be a dentist. He's going
cool.
to dental school, but he sang in choirs and he, you know, and he loved to sing. There was this, thing that he wanted to be able to accomplish with his voice, where I think deep down he knew, but there were those, the moments for me that were just the most satisfying was when he let himself do it. He would just get this big smile on his
yeah.
face and we just knew
yeah.
that he'd accomplished what he had wanted to accomplish
yeah.
that. And for him, a big part of it was because he worked very hard, but a big part of it was just being courageous and vulnerable, because he's a very vulnerable young man. So there's a lot of fear
yeah.
there and he felt safe with me, but
yeah.
it had more to do with just his own
permission
yeah. and feeling of expression.
Wow.
But when those things come out and they persevere despite the difficulties, I had another student who graduated a couple of years ago who, she's a really interesting young woman and very much of a kind of perfectionist mindset. And she would get frustrated, easily frustrated, and just emotional. sometimes, yeah. and that would just cause her to retreat. Now, yeah. sometimes that happens, but with her, it was happening a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I thought, maybe I'm giving her too much allowance
yeah,
okay. to just collapse
sure.
into it rather than moving on. And I have this really vivid memory of her one day getting to that place where I could tell
yeah.
she was just on the verge. And I looked down. Right at her and I just said, I took my finger at her. I said, no,
yeah,
we're not going there.
We're not doing that today.
No.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she was like, okay. Yeah. And then she was able to do it. And I mean, there are times when that's going to happen. And, yeah. I cry with my students if they're having a hard time.
Yeah.
I just can't not, you know, if yeah. they're really struggling. But we come to a point of solution, you know, together with that. And, you know, just sometimes it just says, okay, I'm going to pull myself up by my bootstraps today.
Yeah.
And just, you know, even having that, I mean, just the intuition or just the sense of even the energy in the room sometimes
yeah.
to say, that's what we need. That's just what we need to do today. That's how we need to work today.
Totally.
And, I have this other young man who I'm working with right now. That he's going to be a senior next year, and I have been working with him this whole time. And he's a really interesting fellow, works super, super hard, and he was a music ed major, and but just didn't have the inclination to work with youngsters.
Okay.
So it was not really a good fit for him, but they kept, because he was a good student, they kept kind of moving him through and pushing him through.
Sure.
And he got to his final barrier and they told him no.
Whoa.
And which actually was an interesting thing because he was relieved.
Yeah.
But just wishing they would have
done it sooner
because we all kind of knew and we're just yeah. kind of waiting for that to happen. But he physically would work just really hard. We just carry a lot of... Yeah, just body
kind
would
of
just
bracing yourself,
up,
tension,
bracing yeah. himself. And we tried something kind of interesting that I'd never really done with a student before, because I'd worked with him a lot on relaxation and breathing and different things. But when it got back to the singing, it was only really a temporary fix and his body would get rigid again.
Yeah.
But with him discarding this extra burden that he had, we were in a lesson one day and I said, okay, let's just use our imaginations. I said, I'd like you to just sing with your eyes closed.
Yeah.
And his whole body just,
yeah,
his yeah. whole body just relaxed. And he's not one to show a lot of emotion, but, when we were finished with the passage or whatever it was we were doing, he opened his eyes. And he didn't have the words to say, you know, yeah. what he was experiencing, but we both felt that there it is.
Yeah. It's so inspiring. And just these kind of like beautiful, small moments of intuition and, creativity, like what can we do? Where can we meet this person? And yeah. yes, sometimes it's something physical. I mean, I remember this is not, groundbreaking or anything, but it was for me. You had me sing something like upside down. And mm-hmm. I just remember feeling mm-hmm. like it just felt so easy. And that really cracked something open in my brain of like, oh, just reorienting my body to gravity can have this like huge effect, you know, and we never know like what these, you know, I guess we do sometimes mm-hmm. know, but, mm-hmm. but I mean, yeah. maybe as a student or as this particular student teacher pair, we never quite know what are going to be those just little things that kind of help us
yeah.
crack something open.
Or that are just the right words at the right time.
Yeah.
And, it's just talk about creativity. It's just like every day.
Yeah.
Every day going
brand
into it.
Brand new problems yeah. and brand new people. And
yeah.
Yeah, totally. I feel it so much. Well, this has been a beautiful conversation. I have two questions I ask everybody at the end, but before yeah. I ask those, is there anything else that you wanted to say?
I can't think of anything at the moment. Great. But
I was just like to give people like just a little window in case. Okay, so my last two questions are, on this day, do you have a dream collaboration, or who would you love to do a project with, or, and the who could also be a where, or a piece. You know, it could be.
Wow, that is really an interest. I have to give that some thought because I haven't let my brain go to that space because I've just been I'm at this phase of life as I look to retirement, and I'm going to be, my plan is to move to St. George. Actually, okay. I've just always felt drawn to St. George. Is the path I have in front of me is creating this new life when I go into it. And that's all an element of that. Like music cannot not be a part of it.
Right.
My bigger focus has been, what do I want to create with this life I have in front of me? So, in terms of collaboration, I mean, it definitely will involve the people that I'm around.
It's a collaboration with St. George.
With St. George, with the communities of the people that I'll encounter. I'm looking to that. What do I want to create? I want my new life to look like?
That's awesome. That's really exciting. And then finally, where can people find your work? Or find you if they want to know more about you or see your singing?
That's a good question too. I've kind of put myself off. Probably Facebook is the best place to contact me.
If they search on YouTube, will they find your singing or teaching?
Probably not.
Okay.
Yeah.
If you want to know more from Anna, you can follow her on Facebook.
Yeah. Follow me on Facebook feel free to message me.
Okay.
I grew my career outside of social media because social media was not...
It was brand new.
It was brand new. And I mean, I even went... My whole college experience was without the internet. And I really honestly admire what it takes to begin creating now a career, because you have to employ those elements.
Yeah.
You just have to. And I've been a bit more withdrawn.
Yeah. I mean,
in terms of those kinds of things. So
if someone was dying to follow up with you on something.
So please feel free. It's just Anna Moy, Mooy on Facebook, or my email is anna.moy@gmail.com.
Great. Anna, thank you so much. What a joy. Thank you.
I've loved it. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Artifice. Our theme song is As You Are from my album Masks, with artwork and merch designs by Sarah Keel. If you'd like to recommend a professional artist for an interview on the podcast, you can reach me through my website, emilymerrillmusic.com. That's emilymerrillmusic.com. And don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Thanks again. Have a great week.